I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, they make headlines when they misstep, but otherwise, who are the presidential candidate's advisors? But first, news today that 3 months after the CIA admitted to destroying videotapes that showed the harsh interrogations of two terrorism suspects, the Pentagon has acknowledged that it has nearly 50 additional recordings of its own interrogations. The New York Times broke the story today. Reporter Mark Mazzetti joins us. And Mark, who is on these tapes, and why are they turning up now?
They're only turning up now, first off, is because the Pentagon has done a sort of worldwide search for its own interrogation tapes. The search was started in January, about a month after the CIA acknowledged that it had not only taped interrogations, but also destroyed those tapes. The tapes that we know about so far show two detainees, Jose Padilla and Ali Almari, both of whom are in a military brig in Charleston, South Carolina, and have been for several years. The Pentagon review is not yet complete, so it's still a question of whether there are more tapes out there than the almost 50 that we know about.
And we'll just put it in context. What are the Defense Department's policies on videotaping interrogations and keeping tapes?
Well, that's part of the problem, is that there is not or does not seem to have been one uniform policy. It, to some extent, depends on where the recordings go on, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay. Different commanders had different policies, and that's one of the problems that as they get their arms around this to figure out why they were taped and how many tapes exist. For the record, they say that generally they do not make a practice of taping. They say that it, in some cases it might distract the detainee from the interrogator, that he'll focus on the camera, although some have said that the tapes are a valuable asset because you can go back and review the interrogation sessions.
Well, government officials tell you that one tape showed one suspect being manhandled, getting rough treatment by FBI agents. What do they mean by manhandled?
Well, it's still a bit unclear what was going on. This one detainee, Ali Almari, was, we believe, gagged by his captors as he wouldn't stop chanting, according to one official, and duct tape was put over his mouth. There is also a question of whether he was pushed around a bit by his captors. To be clear, there is no hint that the treatment of Mr. Mari was anything approaching some of the things that CIA is known to have used, some things like waterboarding. However, it seems to be treatment that goes beyond what the Pentagon says it now uses, which is non-coercive treatment.
Well, as you say, officials told you they saw no waterboarding or anything approaching torture, but as you just said, the treatment did go beyond what the Pentagon allows. So is there a sense that there's going to be a follow to that story?
Well, I think in part it would be a question of when it took place. The Pentagon in 2005 banned all coercive treatment. There's acknowledgement that there were some errors in the past and that there were things that went beyond, there was treatment that went beyond what is now defined as approved techniques. So it is a question of whether anything that happened in the past would be followed up on. The other question is whether it was even military interrogators. If it was FBI interrogators, then it would be a question of what are the FBI guidelines. For the record, the Pentagon's now saying that nothing they did or nothing that they saw in the videotapes was illegal or unauthorized.
Well, let's take one suspect at a time. Almari's lawyer has been fighting to see interrogation videotapes. Has he been able to see these, and have any of them of his client been destroyed?
In terms of the question of whether he has seen the tapes, his lawyers have been petitioning for several years to see any and all interrogation tapes. A judge ruled in 2006 that the government did not have to produce the tapes as part of any kind of discovery. The problem is there's really not a legal procedure ongoing right now because he hasn't been charged because he's an enemy combatant. But it's now a question, and now that the Pentagon has acknowledged that these tapes exist, whether the lawyers will now be able to get to see the tapes.
And again, Ali Almari is considered an enemy combatant, the only one being held in mainland America. He was arrested in Illinois. Jose Padilla was sentenced in January to 17 years in prison for his role in terrorist conspiracies. Do we know if his lawyers have been able to see these tapes?
The tapes of Padilla have been known about, yes, and they, I believe the lawyers have seen at least some of them. There is a question, as you raised earlier, about whether the tapes that exist are every tape that's ever been made, or whether there's some that have been recorded over or destroyed in the past, and that's really still an open question.
Mark Mazzetti, Washington Bureau correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Geraldine Ferraro has become the latest advisor to bow out of the race for the presidency. Ferraro, the 1984 Democratic vice presidential nominee, said last week that Barack Obama, would not be the party frontrunner if he weren't black. Well, after criticism from Obama's campaign, she said this on NBC News.
I personally think that this is the last time that the Obama campaign is going to be able to play this type of a race card, because I think that's what it is.
Well, Ferraro's exit from the campaign yesterday took her down a well-trod path. Harvard professor Samantha Power, senior foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama, resigned after she called Hillary Clinton a monster. There was also Bill Shaheen, a Clinton supporter who cited Obama's admitted drug use. Then he resigned as co-chair of the Clinton campaign in New Hampshire. Well, today we want to take a look at the candidate's remaining advisors. We start with Jonathan Allen of CQPolitics.com and the Clinton campaign. And Jonathan, just briefly, do you think this flap over Ferraro will hurt Clinton, or, like many of these exits, will just fade?
I think it's one of those things that's a piece in the puzzle. It's not certainly not the kind of thing that ends a campaign or probably one that boosts it a whole lot. Generally speaking, I think it's the kind of thing that just sort of polarizes the two sides. So if you support Barack Obama, you probably think it's a big deal. If you support Hillary Clinton, you probably think it's a regrettable blip.
Well, let's take a look at some of the advisors who remain and what they might mean about the campaigns. We know some of the names. Mark Penn, for instance, on the Clinton campaign, he likes to say he's chief strategist. He's also a lobbyist. He's an ad whiz, ad guru. But who else? Who are some of the people whispering in her ear?
Well, the most important person, I think, is Maggie Williams, who's a longtime advisor and was her chief of staff in the White House. And the reason Maggie Williams is so important is because, obviously, because she's running the campaign, but also because she wasn't always running the campaign. There was a shift last month from Patty Solis Doyle, who was also a longtime Hillary Clinton loyalist, to Maggie Williams. They felt the campaign had not been run all that effectively, and so Maggie Williams was put in place. And obviously, since then, Hillary Clinton won the popular votes in Ohio and Texas, which her husband had said she needed to do to win the nomination. And so Maggie Williams is obviously, her stock has risen as a result of that.
Let's take a look at issues. Foreign policy, for instance. Thomas Edsel writes in the Huffington Post that Hillary Clinton is advised by a foreign policy team dominated by people who might have shared her early support for the war but have changed their minds. People like Richard Holbrooke, who was Bill Clinton's U.N. ambassador and might be Secretary of State for Clinton. What do you see in her foreign policy advice?
The new Clinton team is essentially the old Clinton team. I mean, there are a lot of the same names. And, of course, this happens in presidential campaigns. People become advisors, and they're sort of loosely affiliated with the campaign. They're not actually paid, but they get consulted. And I think that, to an extent, that's an astute observation. I think that most of the country was behind the Iraq War, and so most of the foreign policy advisors at the time also were in favor of the Iraq War. Of course, in the Democratic Party, I think 60% of the House Democrats had voted against it. So there certainly was that split among Democrats at the time, but you wouldn't have to go far to find foreign policy advisors who were in the sort of Democratic establishment and the old Clinton administration who were supportive of the war at the time.
Well, she also has Madeleine Albright, who was an early critic of the war. But how about on economic issues? Who's on her bench?
To some extent, I think that her best player, and I say this because I saw him working this past week in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, is her husband, Bill Clinton, on economic issues. You'll recall his campaign in 1992, It's the Economy, Stupid. Hmm. It's the kind of thing that connects extremely well with voters, and I think he's got a tremendous sense of sort of empathy with voters and gets immediately what people are telling him about what's going on in their lives. As far as more structured economic advice, you know, again, it's a similar cast of old Clinton players.
Well, speaking of which, there's Harold Ickes, a former White House chief of staff for President Clinton. His job is to win over the superdelegates?
That's basically right. He's a longtime Democratic insider. His father, I believe, was an aide to Franklin Roosevelt. And he knows everybody in the party, and his job at this point is really to work on the superdelegates, to work them one-on-one, and to figure out who the best people to contact them are.
Hillary Clinton has also brought in two experienced political hands from her husband's White House. There's Doug Sosnick, who was political director, and Steve Ricchetti, deputy chief of staff under President Clinton. But you know, before we move on to John McCain, who is it, Jonathan Allen, who is on Hillary Clinton's team, who is whispering in her ear when she responds, let's say, to a Geraldine Ferraro comment?
It's got to be the whole team there. I mean, it's those top people that we were talking about. It's Maggie Williams and Mark Penn and Howard Wolfson and her husband and probably the folks you mentioned, Sosnick and Ricchetti. And so, I mean, it doesn't take long for these folks to get together and figure out what the response is and get it out. But I imagine that it is largely a collective decision. Of course, that has been a problem for the Clinton campaign to this point, when her advisors are.
Well, let's move on to John McCain. That the headline in the Washington Post is "The Anti-Lobbyist Advised by Lobbyists." Do you think that's fair?
It certainly is, in that several of his chief advisors are lobbyists or have been lobbyists. Charlie Black, for instance, is one of the best-known lobbyists in Washington, D.C. I believe Rick Davis, the campaign manager, has been a lobbyist. The reason that it might not be fair is that that's true of all the campaigns. There are lobbyists and former lobbyists working in the Clinton campaign. There are former lobbyists working in the Obama campaign. And so it's hard in Washington to go very far without running into a lobbyist. Usually what happens is these folks who work in administrations, who work in the political game, when their party gets out of power or when their guy that they worked for or the woman that they worked for loses or retires, they go looking for work, and oftentimes they are valuable as lobbyists. So in a down cycle for them, in terms of being a political player, they go work for a lobbying firm, make some money, and then get back into the political game. And I think you're seeing that with some of the McCain advisors.
For instance, Tom Daschle is an advisor to Barack Obama and a lobbyist at this point.
That's a perfect point, Robin.
But speaking of McCain, you know, some have pointed out that since he's still working as a lawmaker, in addition to running for president, it gets a little sticky. One of his advisors was involved with that controversial $35 billion Air Force tanker contract that went to a European producer rather than to Boeing. And, you know, McCain has said of that, you know, I'm proud to have saved the taxpayers billions of dollars. But many people on the right are critical of those jobs going overseas. And it was his advisor who also was working on that deal.
That's an issue that's going to dog McCain. I mean, as long as he has active lobbyists lobbying on issues that he cares about as a member of Congress, his argument would be that over the course of time, people have seen his record and that most folks believe him to be highly independent. And so if there's a coincidence of the lobbying and what he's doing, it is that it's a coincidence. That'll be his argument. I think that it's an issue that will continue to plague him a little bit as the campaign goes on, because it does, as you suggest, sort of scratch away a little bit at that sheen of being a reformer, of being independent, of lobbyists.
That's Jonathan Allen from CQPolitics.com, helping us look at the candidates' advisors. And, of course, we know all the candidates can speak for themselves as well, quite well. But when we come back, more on John McCain's team, then Barack Obama's bench. And later today, we want to note timber, trees coming down in record numbers, cut by poachers who then turn around and sell them for their valuable hardwood. It's a big problem. But back in 1 minute, more of the advisors to the candidates here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Jonathan Allen of CQPolitics.com talking about the top advisors behind the presidential candidates. Coming up, Barack Obama's team, but first more of the players on John McCain's bench. There's Steve Schmidt. He ran the 2004 Bush campaign war room. Now he's with McCain. McCain's media advisor is Mark McKinnon. He was media strategist for President Bush's White House campaigns. He's known for wearing a cowboy hat. But Jonathan, will all these Bush ties help McCain because these are people who've won, or will this be thrown back at him?
I think it can only help him. As you point out, these folks are experienced. They know what they're doing in campaigns. Even the Bush campaign wasn't their first campaign. You mentioned Steve Schmidt. He used to work for the National Republican Congressional Committee trying to elect Republicans to Congress. You know, the connections that they have and the sort of subterranean link to the Bush administration is a strong thing for John McCain when it comes to convincing Republicans that he is he's the guy to take that mantle of the conservative from George Bush. And it's a way that most people won't watch. It's not a public, you know, going and shaking hands with every televangelist in the country. It's something that happens a little bit below the surface, but sends those messages and allows those people also to recruit new Bush people, new Bush Bush donors who haven't given to McCain yet.
The campaign manager, Rick Davis. McCain, speechwriter, has been with him for almost two decades. Mark Salter, just your thoughts on that connection?
He's apparently the closest to McCain in terms of a friendship as a collaboration. Salter has co-written McCain's books and was his top aide in the Senate for a long time. When you talk about people who have the candidate's ear, you'd have to think that Mark Salter is close to that ear as anybody else.
Jonathan Allen covers politics for CQPolitics.com, giving us a look at the benches of the McCain and Clinton campaigns. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
And now for a look at Barack Obama's advisors, we go to Peter Canellos. He writes the National Perspective column for the Boston Globe and wrote recently that the actions of Obama's advisors raise as many questions about Obama as about the advisors. Peter, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to talk to you.
Well, Peter, you wrote this about his advisors after the Austin Goolsbee story. Austin Goolsbee, the economic advisor who told the Canadians that Obama's anti-trade rhetoric might have been political. After Samantha Power told the BBC that Obama might change his plan to withdraw troops from Iraq once he got in office. Do you see those comments from those aides as something drastically different from Geraldine Ferraro's comments?
Well, they are different because they're differing with Obama on matters of policy, and it raises the question of whether Obama is, you know, sincerely going to follow through on the things that he mentions on the campaign trail, or if there are other agendas, or even if there are clashing agendas sort of within the Obama camp. You know, in the past, when we've seen advisors kind of go off message and kind of substitute their own views for that of the candidate, it generally suggests some sort of a problem with the candidate. You know, he's not maintaining a consistent enough message that everybody's kind of with the program.
Well, that might be the nature, though, of the Barack Obama team, because the Chicago Herald writes they have a well-cultivated insurgent feel, which is both good news and bad news. Susan Rice, another foreign policy aide to Obama, said that neither Obama nor Clinton is ready to handle that 3 a.m. phone call announcing a foreign policy crisis. She says she meant that no one is prepared for such a call, but John McCain, of course, jumped on that. And then there's retired General Merrill McPeak, who told the L.A. Times that Barack Obama has real gravitas and doesn't go on TV and have crying fits, which was seen to be a slam at Clinton that Obama's campaign apologized for. So, you know, maybe there's an insurgent feel which is appealing to people about Obama's campaign, but what? That's potentially a problem?
So, yes, I think it could be a problem. I think an effective president traditionally has maintained a consistent message.
Well, let's take a look at the rest of the Obama team, which is huge. 500 advisors on the domestic front, 200 on foreign policy alone, divided into 20 subgroups, many from the Bill Clinton administration, like Susan Rice, and also Anthony Lake, a foreign policy and national security sort of head. Tell us more about what that means.
There's certainly a group of former Clinton advisors, including Tony Lake, to some degree reflects kind of internecine battles that had been within the Bill Clinton administration. Susan Rice is an Africa expert. Samantha Power had also been an Africa expert. Because Obama himself is a little bit less experienced, he's putting forward more of these advisors to try to attest to his gravitas and to show that he has, you know, a lot of experienced people advising him. But the other thing that's going on is a lot of these advisors are jockeying among themselves for positions in the possible future administration. So some of them have kind of an incentive to get out there and be a little more outspoken and establish themselves as Obama's person on a certain issue.
Let's take a look at some of the other names. Many people here in Massachusetts were not surprised when Barack Obama was using words that were used by our governor, Deval Patrick, because they share the same political strategist. Tell us about David Axelrod.
Well, David Axelrod's a former newspaper reporter who about 30 years ago got into political consulting. He worked with Harold Washington, who was the first black mayor of Chicago. You know, one of the things Axelrod learned in Chicago is that black candidates can put together a very effective coalition if they embrace a change message, a sort of positive change message, you know, and combine that with sort of the traditional support in the black community. He has a slight populist reputation for taking on sort of people against the powerful issues, but doing it in a unifying, all-embracing kind of way.
We've mentioned Austin Goolsbee from the University of Chicago, but also Michael Froman, who was the former chief of staff to then-Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. They're called the Free Market Economic Team. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. While Obama has won over the support of people who tend to be a little bit more liberal and a little bit more activist than Hillary Clinton, it's important to sort of look at the fine print and realize that Obama is not running a particularly left-wing campaign. I think Obama does believe in free markets and probably is not as radically opposed to global free trade as some of his rhetoric occasionally sounds. And so this sort of reassuring to the markets and to Wall Street that, you know, an Obama administration is not going to represent some sort of a sea change in economic policy.
Is there anyone you see on the horizon ready to put the next foot in mouth?
Well, what's happened, I think, is that at this stage of the campaign, so many people are getting on board the different campaigns and are joining these various committees that it's going to be very hard for the candidates to control them. You know, certain House members who've endorsed one or the other is going on local television and sort of saying intemperate things, and I think we're going to be in for a few more of them.
Well, that rounds out our look at the advisors of all three remaining campaigns with Peter Kanellis. He writes the National Perspective column for the Boston Globe. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, a cautionary tale about online gambling. You can't read a poker face over the Internet. Also, jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, for many Christians, Lent means meat-free Fridays, and one church has a solution, a weekly fish fry. That's after the news, Here and Now. Some of the country's most valuable trees are disappearing, and it's not because of some invasive disease. They're being cut down, hauled away, and sold illegally to unsuspecting lumber yards or on the black market, often in Europe and China. From old-growth cedar in the Northwest to black walnut in the heartland to maple in the Northeast and koa in Hawaii, tree poaching is on the rise. Trees are being taken from federal land, timber company holdings, and increasingly from private homeowners. One of the victims there is Jerry Pistol. He lost more than 100 oak and hickory trees worth about $10,000 from his 400-acre property in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, what happened?
Well, on January the 11th, my son heard a piece of heavy equipment operating close to our house. And he went out back and discovered that a neighbor was snatching trees.
Did you talk to your neighbor about what they were doing? I mean, what?
We didn't find anybody.
Oh.
So we knew who owned the land. We knew who the truck belonged to. We ran that down. I filed a complaint with the sheriff's office, and we found out, talking to the sawmills, that this is a habit that this guy's got. I talked to one fellow who told me, he said, Jared, they took 22 tractor trailer loads of logs. He said, I was able to find 10 of them, and they've been paid $12,000 for the 10 tractor trailer loads.
Well, we know you are considering a civil and a criminal suit.
Against him, yes.
Yeah, again, on the advice of the Attorney General. And you now are aware of this sort of tree rustling which has been going on. Let's turn to Dee Riley. She's executive director of the Appalachian Roundtable, or Appalachian, as it's called in that region. It's a nonprofit group that provides resources and legal help to victims of tree rustlers. Dee, is it that big a problem?
We are affected literally not only in Appalachia, but nationwide. And some of the values that are stolen in this timber are hundreds of thousands of dollars. The real issue that these landowners are facing is that this has become essentially a racketeering game. You have very astute operators that will designate properties where they know there are elderly landowners or absentee, partially absentee landowners. They will go in, they will cut their trees down, pull the timber out, and sell that timber for only a fraction of its value to a local timber mill.
And we understand you have a waiting list from people across the country of a year just to get help.
The nonprofit was formed to assist in the betterment of the socioeconomic status of the people of Appalachia, the poorest region in the United States. And one of the first issues that came to our attention is an individual just lost $70,000 worth of trees. They have little income, and they literally cannot get these guys prosecuted.
I mean, isn't there a law that if somebody comes and takes trees off, I mean, it's not a mistake of a property line or something, if they come and truck away lumber, isn't that stealing?
It is. And in truth, most states have felony criminal statutes on the books. The problem is that loggers have found a loophole in the system that says, oh, well, hey, wait a minute, I didn't realize I was on your property.
Well, a few states, including Mississippi and Virginia, have already moved to curb tree poaching by enacting laws that make illegal logging on private property a felony.
We have done so in Kentucky, and we currently have in the Kentucky Senate a Senate Bill 171 being proposed in Kentucky that makes the cutting or stealing of a tree an automatic felony, which includes forfeiture and seizure rights for the law enforcement agencies so that they may seize the property and help fund the continuing prosecution of those thieves.
You talk about this sort of accidentally on purpose loophole kind of.
Yes.
How can that be when there are logging trucks? You know, I mean, it's they've been in different areas. How can they get away with that?
Many of these individuals, frankly, are directly associated with the timber mills, and those are the individuals. When a victim goes to law enforcement, what shows up is a very prominent and, frankly, wealthy business owner. So it's very difficult to say when someone says, oops, it's my mistake. Often what they do is they offer a very small retribution amount. If the victim makes the mistake of accepting any money, then essentially they claim a contract payment was made.
So be sure not to take that money, perhaps.
Be very sure not to.
Well, you know, we've been talking about the financial worth of the trees, but there's that other worth of a tree, an irreplaceable worth. What do people tell you about that?
Well, let me tell you, the real crisis is it's not just obviously the loss to the victim. It's the damage to the property. And for example, in Appalachia, those hills and those trees provide the water to metropolis such as Lexington, Kentucky entirely. The damage that occurs, the environmental damage, that washes into the streams, which creates problems very long-term and with a million people. So it's a very far-reaching damage.
Well, this is deforestation.
It really is, and not to mention the aesthetic damage to the entire region, so you can see the economic stress.
Well, you know, this is also a very emotional issue to people. In Ohio, we're reading about a 60-year-old who was as old as the trees that were planted by his father. He watered them as a child.
Fred. Fred Bennett.
Oh, this is devastating to him.
Have you read the Potter story yet?
No, tell us.
Well, they literally maintained for five generations oak trees that each dated between 250 and 350 years of age. They lost 39 of those magnificent oaks after spending their entire life protecting those trees. Their children essentially have no inheritance, nor do they have the trees that five generations of their family refused to cut despite their value.
Oh, boy.
Just the other day, my neighbor comes in and he discovers that a bunch of his trees have been cut and the value of the timber that was gone was $75,000.
Well, we're reading a story in the New York Times about a couple from Royalton, Vermont. The trees have been in their family for generations, and there's a great love for the trees. In Flint, Michigan, tree thieves stole trees from Main Street. They're stealing them from city parks. How can people protect themselves?
Well, one of the most important things they can do is obviously to keep an eye on their property. Number two, what we are suggesting is that they literally put signage up that says, absolutely no tree cutting. And believe it or not, we're going to have to begin to post trees as you post your own private property.
And do you think that'll stop the tree poacher?
No, because the theft is intentional. We have very good, legitimate loggers throughout our country. And frankly, this issue has caused a huge problem for them because it devalues. You have to understand, when you sell a tree for less than its value, it's then shipped to China and or Europe. You are literally bringing down the total value of that entire commodity. So this is a huge problem, literally worldwide. And will it stop them? No, because it's intentional. The only real way to stop them is for everyone to contact their legislators, senators, local law enforcement, and insist that these guys be prosecuted. It is a criminal act.
It's as close to domestic terrorism as you can get. And the thing of it is, there's not enough teeth in the law to really put these people out of action. The only thing that's going to put them out of action is some of them going to jail.
That's Jerry Pistol. He's a landowner in Cookeville, Tennessee, who lost 108 oak and hickory trees to tree poaching. We've also been speaking with Dee Riley. She directs the Appalachian Roundtable. That's a nonprofit group in Letcher County, Kentucky, providing advice and legal help to victims of tree rustling. Thanks, both of you, for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick look at some stories in the works. There's a move to make guns legal on college campuses. We'll speak with a student who carries a gun in Utah, but also hear from a student at Virginia Tech and a campus cop very much against arming students. Also, an emergency medical technician who writes a blog will go inside his life. That's stories that are coming up for you. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, for Christians around the world, Lent is the reflective period leading up to Easter Sunday. And for some people, it's also a time to refrain from eating meat on Fridays. So with beef, pork, and poultry off the table, attention turns to fish. And to accommodate seafood seekers, many churches across the country are organizing Friday night fish fries. Producer Nikki Tundle visited one of these meatless affairs at a Catholic church in Minneapolis.
Sharon Glover is standing in the middle of the church kitchen, making the sign of the cross with her batter-covered hand. She's in charge of the night's Lenten meal at St. Philip Catholic Church in North Minneapolis, and she's praying that the supersized dessert recipe did indeed call for 9 eggs.
I'm making devil's food cake. We had angel food before, so that was a good one. That was a success. So now it's the devil's turn.
The way Glover sees it, you don't have to be somber to be saved. And that should probably be St. Philip's mantra as well. The church basement boasts a huge electronic bingo board. The choir is accompanied by drums and a bass guitar. And parishioners here love swapping tales about their childhood fear of nuns. Over in the kitchen corner, Michelle Patterson is dropping breaded catfish into a vat of bubbling oil. Like the majority of Catholics, Patterson foregoes meat on Fridays during Lent. Why, she's not quite sure.
I guess that's what God brought down.
Traditions, be they religious or secular, are curious things. They take on great meaning, yet what they actually mean can be surprisingly squishy. Lent is no exception. To hear some churchgoers tell it, the practice of giving up meat emulates the sacrifice God made when he gave the world his only son.
To me, it's to give up something like God gave up.
Others see it as a way to remember Christ's crucifixion on the cross.
Can we give up a little meat for that? You know?
Of course, as worthy as those motivations may be, they're not exactly doctrine. For that, it's probably best to ask someone like Father John Paul Erickson. He's the associate pastor at the Cathedral of St. Paul. He explains Lent as the act of
accompanying our Lord in the 40 days, as described in Scripture, where he fasted and he prayed in preparation for his public ministry. And so the Christian, in union and solidarity with Jesus, spends time in the desert, a desert learning through self-denial how to love.
In simpler terms, the season might be seen as
the time for us to reflect upon our relationship with God.
The cathedral's Deacon Philip Stewart admits that formally Lent is a period of prayer and sacrifice and penance. But he says it's also a time to refocus, a time to remember what's really important.
You know, we live in a world where it's a materialistic world, where we are drawing from a lot of sinful things, and our God becomes something else, whether it be material goods or whatever. Lent gives us an opportunity to reflect upon that and put our more attention upon God so that we can draw closer to him.
So just how does resisting the filet mignon connect people with a higher being?
Way back when, meat was a very scarce thing. So to give up meat was really sacrificial to do that.
And rejecting something so desirable, says Stewart, is a way of expressing belief in and love for something greater. Back at St. Philip's, the fish is ready, there's music playing, and dozens have lined up for the Lenten dinner.
Coleslaw or regular salad?
Church member Doris Law picks up a heaping plate of fish and scalloped potatoes, and she grabs a seat underneath a wall hanging of Jesus.
I like fish. I like that McDonald's has a fish special. Praise God. I'll eat fish just because of the fish special, but I don't feel any obligation, or I don't feel sinful, or I don't feel as if God really gives a rip. I mean, I don't think God cares whether I had fish or I had a chicken sandwich. I think that what's important to him is that I acknowledge the season and that I know what the season is about. God is not interested in all of that stuff we make up.
Still, this lifelong Catholic sits in the church basement on a cold Friday night enjoying a catfish fillet. In fact, she rarely misses a Lenten gathering. She says she loves to celebrate the beauty and power of the Christian season.
Anything that pulls us together is part of the plan. This is more important for us all to be together and then for us just to do things to help each other as much as possible, you know, so that's what it's about.
And really, in a time of war and political divisions and economic uncertainty, what could be more sacred?
Thank you, ladies. You guys have a good weekend.
If there's a sheet cake of devil's food involved, all the better.
Producer Nikki Tundle in Minneapolis. To see photos of Fish Fry Fridays at St. Philip's, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, the blind leading the blind up the Himalayas in 1 minute, here and now. Sometimes we're privileged to hear stories that make us think, what have I done with my life? American Erich Weinmeier was the first blind man to climb Mount Everest. 30-something German Sabria Tenberken was probably the first blind woman to travel alone across China into Tibet to found a school for the blind after German officials told her she couldn't be in their Peace Corps. Either act would be enough for most people, but then Erich and Sabria decided to take a group of blind children from her school to the top of the 23,000-foot peak opposite Everest. Here's Erich describing one of the stops along the way.
This is where Mallory and Irvine camped in the 20s, on one of the very first expeditions to Mount Everest. It also marks the beginning of what people call the death zone, and the very real danger of people getting cerebral or pulmonary edema. That's when your brain or your lungs fill up with fluid, and you've literally got hours to get down, or you die.
That's a scene from a new, brutally honest, beautifully photographed documentary called Blind Sight. And Sabria Tenberken joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello.
Along with her boyfriend and her partner in that school, Braille Without Borders, Paul Cronenberg. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Sabria, let's go back to the beginning. Whatever possessed you to go to Tibet?
I wanted to do development work. I wanted to travel. I wanted to have an adventurous life. And then I thought, what region sounds adventurous enough to me? And I found out about Tibet. I studied Tibetology, created a Braille system for the Tibetan language, and then I decided to go to Tibet by myself without a sighted person to prove that blind people are capable of traveling. And in this way, I wanted to convince the people that I could also run the project by myself.
Well, because you discovered what about how Tibetan children in particular who are blind are viewed?
People see blindness as a punishment for something you have done in your past life. A lot of people think also that blind people are possessed by demons or are cursed by demons.
The kids themselves think this.
Yeah, some of the kids, they come to our project and at first they feel that blindness is something really to be embarrassed about. And later they learn that they don't have to be ashamed to be blind.
Paul, you've co-founded with Sabria the school in Tibet. But now enter a new storyline. You all hear of Erich, a heroic figure to the blind everywhere because of his, you know, climbing Mount Everest. But when he suggested that perhaps let's take some kids up the mountain, did you have your doubts?
Of course we had our doubts. We are responsible, Sabria and I, we are responsible for the safety and for our students. And if something would happen to them, then of course we are the ones to blame. But then we thought, well, the students, they come from the mountains. So, and they have to learn how to handle the mountains.
Let's listen to a scene. Erich has brought along with him his sighted climbing team. Each of the adults will have a child to climb with, and first they're going to train them. Here's Tenzing, one of your students, trying to learn to lower himself down a very sheer side of a mountain. Jeff, one of the guides, trying to talk him through it. Now, let's listen.
Now, stand up and let go of the rock and lean back. Tenzing, let go of the rock and lean back. That's it. Let go of the rope. Let go of the rock. That's it. That's it. Yes. There you go. Good boy. That's it, Tenzin. Do that. Yes. There you go. Good boy.
Okay. That's cool.
I got it. Okay.
All right. Go.
Oh, someone says they were trying to get him to cantilever against the rock, you know, so that he would put his body out a little. He flattened against the rock and slid right down. What does your heart do at that moment?
Well, I didn't see it. That was my big advantage. but of course, I knew that the kids could do it. You know,
Paul's laughing too, but this comment that you just made, of course you didn't see it. And there are jokes made throughout the movie about, you know, being without sight. But I'm wondering, you know, we're seeing the huge peak that you're walking towards, and we're seeing the sheer drop-off on either side of the tiny paths that you're on. Paul, you're seeing this. Are you feeling it, Sabria?
Yes, if I have time to just stand there and listen and put my hands to the rocks and feel the rocks surrounding me, or stepping on ice or on snow and just listening into the ravine, then of course I can feel this huge panorama. But the problem was, a lot of times when we were just standing on a ice lake and we were just listening on stones falling down on the ice, somebody would say from the front, "Hey, hurry up, guys! We no time to playing around in the mountains." So we had this constant feeling of chasing through the mountains and chasing time.
It becomes quickly obvious that there's this tension between these truly wonderful climbers who are giving of their time, but think a certain way, and you, with your experience being blind and your work with blind kids, you think a different way. What was that tension?
Well, from the very first moment, I think there was a conflict of goals. We came with the idea that teamwork is important, that the experience in the mountain, the process of walking through the mountains is important for these kids to conquer their own environment. And Eric, of course, he's a mountaineer. He's a professional mountain climber. Mm-hmm. For him, it's important to stand on top. I think there was a bit of tension, blind versus sight, therefore I like the title of the movie, Blind Sight. I think I came more from a blind perspective, and I think this standing on top is more something from a sighted perspective.
And yet it was Eric, who's blind, who was so pushing, because Paul, wasn't there something else going on? It seemed that he saw himself in those young kids.
Yeah, I think his experience on, of course, he has climbed many mountains, so he knows what it is to be on top there. And I think he really wanted to share that with our students. Another pressure element was, of course, the film team. It's documented. Then, of course, he has sponsors, and they, for them, the most important shot is the one on the top of the mountain.
Well, and here's where the brutally honest part comes in, because you show arguments at night between the adults as to what should happen and what's really best for the kids, which is for the film team. Brutally honest. At a certain point, though, it becomes obvious that there are some kids who have got to get down off the mountain, even though they and Eric are heartbroken. Here he's telling one of them, Tashi, that he has to go. Let's listen.
And when you go down, you'll feel stronger. Your head will stop hurting, you know, and your stomach will feel better. And you'll go down, you'll feel better. And then you can go to Shigatse, and we'll meet you. We'll come down and meet you in a few days.
Of course, Tashi, the young boy, can't see the huge tear coming out of Eric's eye. We won't give away the complete ending of the movie. Let's leave that to viewers. But as much as it's heartbreaking at points, it's just so joyful in its epilogue. What did the amount of climbing that they did do to these kids?
Some of these kids, they really, truly changed. For example, Genzen. Genzen was the more reserved person. He's an incredible, intelligent kid who became blind at age 9. And the first time that he really came out of himself and that he went on singing and dancing in the middle of nothing, you know, he was standing on the cliff. That was actually on the mountain. Later, half year ago, he got a scholarship from an Asian organization, and he went to Malaysia and to Japan all by himself. He never flew before. He took a course in computers, and now he's running the Braille Book production, and that was his dream, what he talks about in the film.
It's amazing what some of these kids are doing, including one of them, at least when the film ends, is helping to run the school that you both founded. Sabria, do you think you've made a dent in the cultural thinking about blindness in Tibet?
I think that our students made a difference because they took the opportunities we gave them. They're running around with their white canes in the city of Lhasa. They're reading Braille in public places, and they're very, very proud of themselves and head up and say, hey, we are blind, so what? And this makes the people think. And slowly but steadily, they start to understand maybe it's not a punishment if they are so happy and if they are so capable.
Sabria Tenberkin is co-founder of Braille Without Borders, a school for the blind in Tibet. We've been speaking with her and her boyfriend, Paul Cronenberg, who also was with her at the school. Six of their students were profiled in the new film Blind Sight. Sabria, Paul, thanks so much for coming in to speak with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, they don't profit from the film, so if you want to help them continue their work with the blind, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.